From awaytogarden.com and robinhoodradio.com, this is Away to Garden with Margaret Roach, your weekly invitation to dig in and grow.
The last couple of years, I've been making a practice of paying closer attention to the insects around me. As regular listeners and readers know from my various adventures on this show and on my website with moths, beetles, dragonflies. So when I saw the title of a book called The Bees in Your Backyard listed in the recent Princeton University Press catalog, I thought, this one's for me. While I can name my local mammals and birds and amphibians and snake species, I admit to using the word bee a little, shall we say, generically. Not even sure I know exactly what a bee is and isn't. Today's guest has that covered and then some. Olivia Carroll is a PhD plant biologist who has been studying bees and the flowers they visit for nearly 20 years. Olivia is also co-author with Utah State Biology Professor Joseph Wilson of The Bees in Your Backyard, the new book that caught my eye. From her own garden in New Mexico, I welcome her to Away to Garden. How are you, Olivia?
I'm good. How are you doing?
Good. I love the book. I'm having fun. I'm looking up close and personal at all kinds of bees, thanks to you and the pictures especially. Amazing.
Good. I'm glad you're enjoying it.
Yeah. And I love the dedication you made in the new book. I want to tell people about it because you made a connection in your dedication between being a mother and a special feeling it's given you for queen bees. Tell me about that just quickly.
Well, quickly. So I just as I started writing this book, I had my first little girl. I now have two of them. But the process of learning how to take care of my offspring, as I was also learning about how mother bees take care of theirs and how much work and dedication they put into making sure that their little ones will have everything they need as they grow and develop in the nest, really struck home for me as I struggled with the same things myself. And so in the end, I originally wanted to put this book is dedicated to all the queen bees, but I altered it a little bit. But
yeah, but I loved it. I thought that was great.
Stay strong, mothers. Stay strong.
Well, and I think there is for people who take the time to slow down, whether, you know, with a science background and a professional interest such as yourself or amateurs like myself, who take the time to slow down and look, there is tremendous inspiration in the natural world. And so that just struck me. That you found that with the queen bees. So now I read somewhere, and I don't remember an interview you had done elsewhere, that your adventure with bees really got serious when you were an undergraduate and undertook what sounds like sort of outward bound with bees. It was like you went on a whole bee adventure. Tell me about that.
Yes. It was an incredible experience. I'm very lucky to have had a boss who was willing to give us inexperienced undergrads opportunities that were, I don't know, probably better suited for someone more experienced, but he's willing to take a chance on us, and I was one of those lucky few. And he had got an opportunity to sample the bees of Pinnacles National Monument, which is in California. They wanted to know what species they had out there and which ones might be associated with what habitats. And so he asked if I wanted to be the one to go out and do the collecting, and he explained it to me. I would have to camp for 3 months at a time. I was going to have to walk around looking at flowers and swinging a net to collect bees for months on end. And did I want to do this? I'm like, yeah.
So you had to go out.
I would much rather do that than be in class.
So you had to go out into the great outdoors in Pinnacles National Monument in California. You had to camp for 3 months with like a net and look at flowers and catch bees. And that was your introduction to bees. That's pretty like hardcore.
That was my Yes, it was. It was amazing. My very first day, I was so nervous. I still remember the very first bee I collected. I was so excited, and look what I caught. And I went to put it in the little vial, and of course, it got away and let it go. But I will always remember the very first one that I managed to nab in my net.
Her first bee.
It was a summer of misadventures, and, you know, I did some things wrong. I did some other things that turned out okay. But in the end, I had these boxes, these little white, sort of the size of a sheet of paper, 8x12 boxes, and full of bees, you know, starting in the spring, and you could see through the boxes transition into the late spring bees, and then they kind of dwindle off in the summer bees, etc. And it was so beautiful. All of the colors and the patterns and the shapes and sizes and big ones, little ones, and long antenna. And it was incredible. And to realize that there were patterns in there, that they were certain ones only visited certain flowers, and that there were all of these interesting relationships with habitats and stuff, struck me enough that I decided I needed to ask more questions about pinnacles, and I ended up going back for two additional seasons.
Wow.
I was hooked. It was, seeing bees in a box like that is a great introduction for any biology student.
I think that I read that it was something like nearly 400 species in an area of 25 square miles or something like that. I mean, it's
yeah.
a lot of bees.
Yes.
So, so the goals for the new book, I know, were to, and I'm paraphrasing, were to really help people to know bees, you know, not have the mere generic perceptions like I admit that I've long had myself, and also to dispel some common myths about them. So both in the hopes that, you know, there'd be more appreciation and understanding of bees, then maybe that would lead to better stewardship by people. And so let's start with, what is a bee and what's not a bee? What's a bee?
Okay. I think that most people who haven't had a chance to learn much about bees, you know, if they close their eyes and someone envisions a bee, the image that comes to mind is most likely a honeybee.
Right.
Certainly very important species, but honeybees aren't necessarily the best representatives of the bees that you find throughout North America. There's probably close to 4,000 species in the U.S. and Canada alone. That's not including Mexico, which has its own suite of special bees. And the honeybee is kind of brown, and it's got the characters of a bee. So it's got the two wings on either side of the body. So if you count them, there's four total. And it's got antennae that are kind of long on its head. And if you look at the back legs, it has special structures for collecting pollen, all of things that make it a bee. And nothing else really has all of those characters put together. So that's maybe a good start, but I guess telling a bee from a fly, one of the biggest differences is a fly just has two wings, one on each side, rather
right.
than two wings on each side. The antenna on the top of a fly's head are very short and stubby. There are very few flies that have long antenna. There's these short, stubby little things, whereas bees have longer ones, probably something to do with smelling flowers and scents and stuff like that. And then flies don't collect pollen, so unless they're trying to mimic a bee that does, they seldom have those pollen-collecting hairs on their legs. And their eyes are often really big and bulgy, and they kind of stick out more than you would see on a typical bee. So those are some of the best characters for telling a fly from a bee.
Mm-hmm. And wasps can really, that's where I lose it with the wasps.
Yeah.
You know, because
yes. they're especially tricky because they're so closely related. When you actually look at how these things are related to each other, you know, in a phylogeny or something, bees are actually a subset of wasps. They are a wasp. They're
right.
a special kind of wasp that has evolved to collect pollen instead of be a predator and eat other bugs. And so for that reason, most wasps have a lot of structures that they have adapted to have long, spindly legs with lots of little spines on them for catching insects, or they have these really long bodies. There's some, you know, a wasp has a fairly typical look that's quite different from the look of the bee, which tends to be more fuzzy. It's interesting, there's a whole lot of wasps that for one reason or another have metallic kind of a shine to their face. If they turn their face in the light, if you're looking up really close, you can usually see that metallic shine on the face of many groups of wasps, but you hardly ever see that on bees. So that's another key. If the face shines in the light, kind of a silvery color, it's probably a wasp.
And what about, you know, we have that expression, a wasp waist, you know, like as in a slender,
yeah.
a pulled-in waist. So is that a real thing that comes from wasps?
It is, and it's quite common among the wasps, but it's not definitive. Not all wasps have that. In fact, you know, if you get right down to it, the real technical difference between a bee and a wasp is that somewhere on a bee's body, it will have a split hair.
It will have a what?
And a wasp doesn't.
It'll have a what?
A split hair. So.
Oh.
A split end on a hair.
Isn't that, again, and it's a fuzzier, generally speaking, yeah, and then it has a
generally speaking.
Split, huh, okay. So What about some of the, you know, the things that people think, these sort of misinterpretations / myths about bees that, you know, we think, besides those sort of physical characteristics that you were talking about that make them different from flies or wasps, what are some of the things that people think are, you know, true about bees that aren't, that you wanted to kind of dispel?
Sure. Okay.
Yeah.
So, coming back, we'll go with the honeybee. So since most people think of the honeybee, and if you really press people, oftentimes they'll be like, oh, yeah, well, I guess I do know there's also the bumblebee. If you ask, well, I guess I have heard of a sweat bee, too. People know there are these other kinds of bees out there, but nonetheless, the honeybee is what people fall back on. And they think of that as the quintessential bee. They live in a hive. They're queens and workers. They make honey. Those sorts of things are associated with all bees. But in fact, the honeybee in the U.S. is one species, Apis mellifera. There's 4,000 other different kinds, and none of them are anything like the honeybee.
Right.
There's no hives
right.
at all. Most of them are solitary, so each female by herself, she acts as both the queen and the worker, and she'll go out and gather all the pollen and nectar that she needs from flowers. She'll bring it back to a nest that she builds by herself and then leaves that in there, and then she lays the eggs in that nest to eat that, but eventually eat that pollen and nectar. So there's no workers helping her out. She does all of this by herself, not in a hive. It's usually one hole, or maybe she'll have a couple different cavities that she goes in, but it's often a hole in the ground or maybe a twig. Or snail shells. Some of them like to nest in snail shells.
Really?
Or something like that. Yeah.
That's crazy.
Yeah. Or pine cones. Pine cones is another interesting place that you sometimes find bees nesting.
Wow.
Yeah, and there's no honey because they don't overwinter. So the female spends her 3 to 5 weeks of adulthood madly dashing around, building a nest, gathering pollen and nectar, laying eggs, provisioning her offspring, and then she seals off the nest, and she dies. That's the end. She never gets to meet her offspring. She never gets to see that they make it through to adulthood.
Sorry, so these, so the ones that only have 3 to 5 weeks of mad rushing around to provision this nest and feed the young, mm-hmm. And then die, these queens, these are which species of bees or which group of bees?
These are the solitary bees.
Solitary bees, okay.
The majority. We're talking like 95% of the bees in this country.
95%, okay.
Yeah.
Okay, all right.
Yeah. So the only ones that don't are a couple species of sweat bees that have evolved their own kind of sociality, something similar to a honeybee, not quite as evolved, and bumblebees and honeybees. And other than that, the rest of them are solitary. Each female is working
wow.
for herself. Sometimes they'll form little cooperatives where a couple females will work together and maybe there will be one nest entrance, but once you go in, there's separate apartments within. Think of it like a hotel. You walk into the door, but inside each person has their own little life.
Huh.
So they'll cooperate in that way, or maybe they'll nest in an aggregation. If you're walking around, this is common in like the southwest U.S., there's a bee called Diadasia. It specializes on either cactus or mallow flowers. And these females will nest in groups of hundreds to thousands of individuals all together, and the road will just be buzzing. It'll look like it's moving. There's so many females, but each one is independently building her own nest in this aggregation together.
Wow. Now, you hinted at one of the myths when you were just talking about the honey. A lot of people think bees, what do bees eat? Bees eat honey. People think, well, again, that's another myth because people are thinking about the honeybee, which is so different
sure.
in so many ways. And plus, I don't think we mentioned, but the honeybee is not a Native American bee, correct?
No, it's not. It came, you know, it's naturalized. It's been here
right.
a long time. But
right.
I like to think of the honeybee as more domesticated.
Yes.
It's the equivalent of a Jersey cow or something.
Yes.
It's been with people for so long now. I guess you could call it domesticated. It came over with the pilgrims, 400 or 500 years ago. And many have escaped, and there are wild honeybees, but nonetheless, it's not native to this country. They came over from Europe and have become very, very common here, but they weren't originally.
Yeah, and it's interesting you say like a Jersey cow or whatever, because in a sense they were farm animals. They were brought to use for
yes.
agricultural productivity to enhance pollination. But also, are there other I've never asked anybody this. Are there other non-native bees in the United States like the honeybee?
Right. There are a lot of other non-native bees, interestingly. But none of them, you say, like the honeybee. None of them are like the honeybee. They're all solitary.
Okay.
And a lot of them, this is interesting, you find this also on islands around the world. There's a lot of bees that nest in wood on islands, and then a lot of the introduced species in the U.S. also nest in wood. So what happens is the bee builds her little nest, maybe over in Europe or maybe in Cuba or something, in wood, maybe on a ship or something that's on a ship. Parted across the waters, and when her offspring emerge the following year, they've been transplanted. They're established in a new place, and that's how islands often get colonized.
I see.
With bees, but it's also how a lot of the introduced species here.
I see. So what about some other bee myths? Like I bet there's one about stinging, because everybody always tells me that a bee dies if it stings you, yeah? But
so that's, you know, a tiny bit that's true. If a honeybee stings you, the sting is left in your skin along with the little venom sacs often. And so she's kind of eviscerated. Her organs are ripped out of her. She's a worker bee, so from the point of view of this individual colony, it's not, it doesn't represent the death of the colony. Whereas if you think of a solitary bee, if she were to lose her sting, that's the end of everything. That's the end of all of the offspring she could have laid. So it's not advantageous for her in any way to lose that sting. Her sting isn't barbed, and so when she stings you, she can sting you again and again and again if she needed to. Generally speaking, though, bees they're not seeking you out to sting you. I hear that a lot. People are afraid of bees because they're afraid the bees are going to come right up to them and sting them. And, you know, I've been collecting bees a lot. I have done more to aggravate bees than most people do in their lifetime, and I have seldom been stung. It's not that common at all. If they don't recognize that you're there, they don't see you as a threat. They have no reason to exert the effort. Another interesting thing people don't know about that is that only the female bees can sting.
Yes.
Because the sting is the modified ovipositor. That's the modified egg layer. So males, obviously, since they're not laying eggs, have no need for an ovipositor, no need for a sting.
So female bees are the only ones.
So if you pick up a bee 50% of the time, it might not even be able to sting you.
Okay. So and so now, just to be clear, a honeybee can sting once before it would die if it stings, because as you said, it's like eviscerated after that because it has that stinger.
You know, I suppose that's generally, yes, that's generally true. I suppose there's maybe if a sting didn't penetrate the skin very far, it could maybe sting you again or something. But generally speaking, I would say, yeah.
But that with
one sting
with,
and they're done.
And then with say a bumblebee, that's not the case.
Yeah, and if you look under a microscope, it's really obvious why, because you can see the barbs on the sting of the honeybee sting.
Oh.
And so it's made to catch and stay back in elastic skin like human
Okay.
Skin.
Okay.
Whereas if you look at a bumblebee sting, it's this long, straight sort of sheath, shaft, I guess. It would be very hard for it to stick and stay in the skin.
So what about when people say, I stepped on a nest of bees? Is that another myth?
I suppose. I mean, when you think about the fact that 70% of bees nest in the ground, sure, it's possible you could step on it, but generally speaking, when people, you know, say they disturbed ground bees is a kind of bee that people talk about, it's not a bee at all. It's a wasp. A lot of wasps nest in the ground. And, you know, if you disturb the colony, you're going to anger them. They're probably going to come out and try and defend it. But bees, no, that's not a bee thing.
Right.
It's mostly wasps.
Right. Some of the easiest ones to identify, you were mentioning the sweat bees before.
Yeah.
Aren't they particularly easy? I mean, I'm just looking at the pictures in the book. I haven't obviously met all these bees up close and personally like you have. But the sweat bees seem like they'd be ones if we wanted to kind of go out in the backyard and start to like get it, besides recognizing honeybees from other bees, the sweat bees look like ones that might be identifiable. Yes?
Yeah. So I would say the easiest ones to get started with, the sweat bees can be a little difficult. They're probably the most nondescript. They're like the little, you know, when you bird, the little bitty brown buggers, I think they call them, the tell me bees, whatever, these birds that are really hard to tell apart. Sweat bees, the Helictus, are these little sort of brown, maybe slightly metallic, really small, almost fly-like in their size and stuff, kind of hard to see. But there is a special kind of sweat bee called the, some people call it the green metallic sweat bee.
That's the one I was looking at, yeah.
Agapostomum is the genus, and there's not a whole lot of species in the U.S., and they're beautiful, just these shimmery greens. Some of them have yellow and black or yellow or black and white stripes on the abdomen. Some of them are green over the whole body, and it's like a flying jewel. And they're all generalists, so they'll visit just about any plant. They seem to like asters, but you can find them on roses and pretty much anything. And so they're quite common in urban areas and gardens and things like that, and they're one that everyone has a good chance of being able to see during late spring, early summer.
Hmm.
Pretty common. So, and what an introduction. They're just such a beautiful bee. That's a great one to start with.
A flying jewel. I like that description. So
they're just so shimmery. They really are. They're beautiful. So, another common one would be the Anthidium. Anthidiini in general, they're these stocky bees. They're real burly. They look like muscle builders, but in bee form. And they've got these beautiful yellow and black patterns on both the thorax, which is the back section, and the abdomen, which is like the belly. And they fly real fast, but they also hover. They have these great hovering patterns, like a helicopter flying real fast and stopping in midair and moving. Anyway, they're real fun to watch. And they're common in summer, mid to late summer. They reach sort of peak.
Interesting.
Peak time for them. And they're often on mint. You see a lot of them on mint flowers, so that's a fun one to look for.
So we only have like another minute or so, and I just wanted to ask you one quick final question. We talked about queens in a few different ways. Is a queen different somehow physiologically, or her chemistry different, or is it just that her role, or can't that be answered simply? Is a queen biologically different when she's born? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I do know what you mean, and that's a good question. I'll try and answer as quickly as I can. It depends on the species that you're talking about.
Okay.
So with honeybees, I believe there's quite a bit of difference there, and how that's determined with honeybees, I'm not exactly sure. I know that with some of the sweat bees, and maybe even with some of the bumblebees, if the queen bumblebee dies, one of the workers can take over that role. They have it in them. And in the sweat bees, they've actually noticed several cases where there's sort of this bullying, and the way that the queen maintains her dominance or her place as the egg layer is by making the others subordinate to her, kind of bullying them around. And if another comes along that can out-bully her or whatever, then that bee can also be a queen, or may split off and start her own colony. So in some cases, I think it's very physiological, and some others, I think it's more of a behavioral.
Interesting. Well, it's the whole subject is so interesting, and the book, The Bees in Your Backyard. Thank you so much, Olivia Carroll. It's really been good to talk to you, and just like in your dedication on the front of the book, I have a growing appreciation for the queen bee status. I hope I'll talk to you again soon. Okay, bye-bye.
I hope so, too. Bye.
And I hope I'll talk to all of the rest of you again soon as well, like maybe next week. So don't miss an episode. You can subscribe free to the podcast version of the show on Stitcher or iTunes. You can find me anytime at awaytogarden.com or at facebook.com/awaytogarden. And happy gardening meantime.
A Way to Garden with Margaret Roach is a joint production of awaytogarden.com and the smallest NPR station in the nation, Robin Hood Radio.